Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We've got live music later on the show from Perfume Genius and his band. But first, I'm going to take you back to New Year's Eve, 1978. We had it all figured out, my friends and I. The plan was see Devo playing at Lincoln Center at 8, and then walk over to the Beacon Theater, where Talking Heads were playing a late show around 10 or so. What we didn't count on was the Devo concert running until midnight. After all, they only had the one album at that point. But what they also had was a bunch of new songs, a film, and a performance art piece from a grown-up baby in a giant crib. This was Boogie Boy, the alter ego of the band's lead singer, Mark Mothersbaugh. When I was born, my hands were small, the baby grew big and picked the fruit that made me think, forget the ways so I could go, reverse the flow. Yes, it was weird, but it was also wonderful, and we never did get to that Talking Heads concert that night, but that was okay. I'd seen them quite a bit already. But seeing Devo that night, that was pretty memorable. Correct that will. Give the past a slip. Step on the brick. Break your mama's back. Now, a lot of people, like me, thought of Mark Mothersbaugh as a musician, the guy that all the Devo madness seemed to revolve around. But it turns out that Devo movie was just the tip of a visual arts iceberg that has occupied Mark Mothersbaugh for 40 years or more. The theme of de-evolution that you hear in his music, well, that's in his visual art, too. An exhaustive exhibit of Mothersbaugh's visual art is opening at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, and a companion book is coming as well. Both are called Mark Mothersbaugh, Myopia. And Mark joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So, myopia, you actually had, and I presume still have, myopia, right?
Yes, and it figured prominently into me becoming an artist, actually. So,
how would that kind of restrictive vision lead you to the visual arts?
I was one of five kids. It's not uncommon for myopia to go undetected for years when you're young, and I was in that category, so that I made it through second grade, almost all the way through second grade, without being able to see what a blackboard was, or be able to see. I knew where the door was because you could follow people and you would find it. And somehow I managed to make it to school every day, but it wasn't till the end of that school year that I got fitted with glasses. And within 5 minutes, I walked out of this. This optometrist shop, and I, for the first time, saw clouds and birds flying and telephone wires and rooftops and smoke coming out of chimneys and the tops of trees. And it was...
You had never seen any of that before.
Well, pictures and books, and I just assumed everybody else had the same vision that I had. I knew kids knew something I didn't know at school. You know, I knew that they knew answers to things like when the teacher would say, would you read the numbers on the board? And then I would go, what's a board? And then all the kids laughed. And then they go, all right, smart guy, get in the corner. And I'd be like, how do they know the right thing to say? But it made me start drawing. Like the next day, the teacher that had been inflicting corporal punishment on me said, hey, you draw trees better than me, and that kind of did it.
Wow. And so it was visual art first for you.
Yeah, I thought music was invented to torture me, because at the same time I got my glasses, I started taking keyboard lessons. And so my friends would be outside the window, like, making a face, you know, laughing while I'm sitting in there playing Bone Sweet Bone. And... You know, it wasn't until I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan because my dad would set a TV right next to the dinner table, because with five kids, that was one way to kind of control the chaos.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing that and going, that's why I've spent my whole life being tortured with music lessons. And so.
Well, now, you mentioned there are five kids, three of whom would be in the original lineup of Devo.
And that would be correct, yes.
Yeah. Now, the band's sort of creation story is an odd one, because you were at Kent State at the time of the shooting.
Right.
And what did they closed the campus down after that tragic event, and for a couple of months you didn't have access to the visual, to the printmaking machinery that you'd been using.
Right. I met Jerry Casale in 69, and we collaborated on visual art projects, and we were both in bands that were kind of helping us pay our tuition and the way through school. And then we were also protesting and thought it was a good thing. And we were there for 30-some kids to get shot. And they did close the school down in May of 1970. And so Jerry would come over to my place, and we write music together, and we were trying to figure out what we were seeing in the world, and we decided we weren't seeing evolution, we were seeing de-evolution.
Well, now, so here's the question, is like, you know, with the band growing initially out of this kind of watershed moment in American politics, how did you and Jerry decide how overtly political your art was going to be, whether it was visual or musical?
Well, what really shocked us was when, you know, May they closed the school down. September they started it back up again. And when we went back to school, it was a totally different atmosphere. It had been this very exciting, full of, you felt empowered as a student before that. And then all of a sudden it was like, everybody was like, that was a little bit too real. Let's just get back to the business of school and forget anything about what's going on in the world around us. And music took a big turn, it seemed like, right at that time. It's like, what came up next was disco and corporate, you know, like power rock, and both of them had politics that we weren't particularly enamored with, and it seemed like all the Bob Dylans of the world were gone, and so we thought, well, we're going to be musical reporters and talk about the good news of de-evolution.
Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo with me here in the Soundcheck studio. The exhibit of his visual art and some sonic art as well, which we can talk about, is called Mark Mothersbaugh, Myopia. It opens on October 30th at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver. The accompanying book is out on November 4th. And you can see some of the artwork that we'll be talking about on our website at soundcheck.org. I want to play a little bit of Mongoloid. This is the version that's on the first Devo record. There was the single before that as well, which has an even more raw sound. But it's, you know, is this kind of reportage of de-evolution?
Yeah, I think so. I think we decided we were going to get out our pad and paper and observe things and make our own comments, and Mongoloid fit very well into that.
This is from the first album called Are We Not Men? We Are Devo. And the song Mongoloid, which doesn't just appear on the first Devo record. Mark, it is also one of your earliest music videos, way in advance of MTV.
Yeah, ironically, that was the only video we never made ourselves. It was made by a video artist that resided in San Francisco at the time named Bruce Connor. And he had come to see the band at Mabuhay Gardens and really enjoyed the band. And he had seen films we'd made and then said, hey, can I make a film? Mm-hmm. And so I gave him a copy of the tape on a quarter-inch reel-to-reel, and then came the video. He made an awesome video, too.
Yeah. Well, so did you guys for a lot of those early songs. And again, this sort of goes back to kind of the synchronicity between the visual and the sonic arts for you. I mean, you've sort of pursued both simultaneously.
Right. We were a part of the of which is now very passé, but we were part of an emerging group of artists that felt like the idea was more important than the medium, and we felt we should be able to have access to whatever medium we wanted to that best solved the problem made the statement we were trying to make.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, here in New York in the late 70s, you had, you know, people like Jim Jarmusch, the filmmaker, in a band, and
right.
You had people like Laurie Anderson, you know, playing the violin on Blocks of Ice, you know, the whole performance as an art unto itself.
Right. It was a good time. It was an interesting time in the arts. And before MTV, there was all this hope that we thought, oh, what we're doing, being sound and vision artists, it's going to make rock and roll irrelevant. that's what we thought we were doing. We thought that all the art school students from around the world were going to take over pop culture. And they were allowed to become part of it,
yeah.
But they didn't really take over.
So you saw the mainstream culture devolving, and you saw the art students as the counterweight, the counterbalance to that.
Right. I saw, you know, Jerry and I, we were thinking of Devo. Like, there was Art Nouveau, there was Art Deco, now there's Art Nouveau. We were turned on by all the art movements in Europe between World War I and World War II, you know, Bauhaus and Dada, and, you know, we were, you know, checking out things like Ballet Mécanique and the futurists in Italy who said an orchestra isn't enough to truly play the music of our culture now. We need other instruments like mm-hmm. foghorns and airplane engines, and we thought, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So there you guys were with your guitars held together with duct tape and all kinds of, like, weird sort of proto-electronic drums and things.
Yeah. My youngest brother, Jim, he played drums with us, and then I kept asking him for V2 rocket sounds and mortar blasts, and there was no electronic drum kits at the time. So he kind of cobbled together his own using an acoustic set going through acoustic guitar pickups into amps on stage, so he'd have wah-wah pedals and fuzz tones and echoplexes that it just made a kind of a incredibly noisy sound.
Yeah.
But I still miss it because it was the most artistic that Devo ever sounded.
Well, now, Devo started making a name for itself at the same time that the New York and London punk scenes were in full bloom. So, you know, almost inevitably, you guys got lumped in with that. Did you feel any kinship with the punk scene here in New York?
Well, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't say that I think seeing the Ramones kind of inspired us, too. You know, it's like we were doing more bluesy. It was a little more bluesy Captain Beefheart, sort of Flintstones meets the Jetsons. And then and we came out to New York and saw what was happening and got really excited. And our songs became more succinct and the tempo got upped and they became more aggressive. And
I do remember when the single of Sloppy came out before the first record, and I thought, wow, that's that's punk in several ways. Then the album version came out, and of course it was Brian Eno who produced the first Devo record.
Yeah.
There's a timeline in the book that mentions a date in Toronto where David Bowie is introducing Devo and saying, I'm going to produce them. Whatever happened to that?
Everything happened in the summer of 77, basically, where we started playing New York. And actually, he came to see us at Max's Kansas City. And we played, you know, you played two sets. Mm-hmm. I forget. I think it might have been Suicide. I don't remember who the other band was that was on that night with us. And we played our first set, and then they played a set. And he came backstage and said, I want to take you guys to Tokyo this winter and we'll do an album together. And we're like, that's great, because we're sleeping in an Econoline van tonight out in Broadway. And so he came out on stage on the second set and introduced us as the band of the future. And he made one caveat afterwards. He said, but if I get a part in this movie called Gigolo, we'll have to push it back to summer or something like that. And we're like, well, we don't have apartments anymore. We don't have anywhere to go. And so he called us up during the middle of the week and said, I just got the movie, so let's push it till summer. And then the next week, Robert Fripp and Brian Eno came to see Devo at the same place. And we went over to Robert Fripp's house afterwards, and they said, hey, can we do anything to help you guys? And Eno said, hey, I'd love to produce you, and I'll tell you what, I know you don't have any money. We don't have a record deal, but I know we could get one, so I'll take care of all the arrangements to make sure you get to Germany, where there's a studio. I think he had just recorded music for Airports at this place called Connie Plank Studio.
Connie Plank, yeah.
Yeah, in Neunkirchen. And so he took us over there, and Bowie would show up on the weekends because he was filming his movie in Berlin, and then he would come in on the weekends, and we would listen to them bicker about the credits for the Low album.
Which is also in progress at this period
of time.
As well. We're speaking with Mark Mothersbaugh, founding member and longtime lead singer of Devo and visual artist as well. And the occasion is the opening of the exhibit Mark Mothersbaugh Myopia, which starts October 30th at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, and the publication of the companion book of the same name, which is out on November 4th. And, you know, as you head through the period where Devo is taking over your life, you know, and you got the record deal and there's the touring and stuff, how did you keep the visual part alive? How did you keep the visual art going?
Well, Jerry and Bob and I were always in charge of our...
When you say Bob, is Bob 1
Bob.
Or Bob 2?
Bob 1. Okay. we were responsible for the visual arts in the band. And even when we made our record deal, we were afraid of the record company designing. We had these nightmares that they're going to design our record covers or our posters for us. And so we cut them off at the pass by going, we'll take 10% less royalties if you let us do our own album covers and our own graphics for our marketing. And they're like, they were kind of like, they were feeling like, wait a minute, did you just pay us to paint our fence for us? We're okay with that. And so we were still responsible for all of the graphics and all of the things like the red hats and the hairdos and things. We designed them ourselves.
And with what about the videos? I mean, the video for Girl You Want is, you know, it's almost like a send up of the tropes of the rock concert.
Well, Jerry and I, we wrote all those concepts together, and we started doing films before there was a such thing as an MTV. So we were like the Little Rascals. Jerry directed these things. Chuck Statler produced them. He went to school with us at Kent, and I did storyboards with him, and we made up the stories ourselves. And oftentimes, we had an idea for a film before we had the song, and we would write a song to go with something that we were laughing about as an idea or something that interested us that we wanted to do.
Could you have an example?
Like Beautiful World was probably fit into that. We had talked about the kind of graphics and things that we wanted to do, and we're looking for a place for them to exist. And I had this music, and Jerry wrote lyrics to go over top of it.
Hmm. So getting back to Girl You Want, which is from the album Freedom of Choice, was the intention here to kind of send up the usual interplay between band and adoring teeny bopper audience?
Yeah, we were making fun of the whole thing, and you know, we were doing things that made us laugh. We had my dad, General Boy, was in the background, like controlling Devo, like we were mechanical, you know, robots on stage, and we found a collection of real little girls and real little boys that would wear wigs and just dressed them all up as girls and had them in like a peanut gallery style audience. And then at the end, when they accidentally flipped the video colors so that everybody was purple instead of whatever our normal colors were, and everything was flipped backwards, we put it out that way and kept having panicked notes come back from different television networks where they're like, we don't know what's wrong with your film. We got the wrong film. Everything's crazy. And we said, well, it was meant to be that way.
So going back to your work with Brian Eno, who had these little oblique strategy cards that he would use, and one of them was honor thy error as a hidden intention.
Yeah, Brian was like, he was probably the best producer we could have been associated with, because he really put up with us, and we were you know, to get out of Akron, and you know, there was no Summer of Love ever in Ohio back in those days. So and bands didn't play original music. That was a big minus if you played anything that wasn't a top 40 hit. So we really thought we knew what the album was supposed to sound like before we even got there. So at a certain point, he just kind of went, okay, I'm going to do these extra tracks. You'll have them available. You can use them or not. And he was good to work with.
Yeah. Well, you know, honoring an error as a hidden intention, the video for this song, Girl You Want, are the videos part of the museum exhibit? Are they...
They're somewhat folded in.
Let's play a little bit of Girl You Want from the Devo album Freedom of Choice. Song Girl You Want from the 1980 album Freedom of Choice. Up next, more with my guest, Devo founder Mark Mothersbaugh. We'll talk about Mark's work on TV shows like Pee-wee's Playhouse and Rugrats, and on Wes Anderson's Moonrise Kingdom. And later, Mike Hadrius, who performs under the name Perfume Genius, joins us to perform songs from his latest album, Too Bright. That's coming up. This is Soundcheck. Join me for a special Soundcheck Halloween pre-party with the band Primus. Les Claypool and his merry band will join us to play songs inspired by the 1971 film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Come enjoy the music and come in a Willy Wonka-inspired costume. It's all happening October 30th at 1 p.m., special afternoon show. Details and tickets at wnyc.org/thegreenspace. Let's go. Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with my guest, Mark Mothersbaugh, the visual artist and musician and founder of the band Devo. The exhibit of his visual art opens October 30th at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, and the book comes out on November 4th. Both are called Mark Mothersbaugh, Myopia. Meanwhile, you can see a lot of Mark's art on our website at soundcheck.org. And when I say a lot, I mean there are 30,000 just of the postcards, the postcard art that you've done pretty much throughout your career, right?
Yeah. It kind of started off in like 69, 70. I found out that if there was something called mail art. And
right.
It was back when people relied on the post office for transmitting information. Now you just get garbage mostly
and bills
if you sent a piece of art on a postcard to somebody like Robert Indiana or Irene Dogmatic or Image Bank or Ant Farm, they would send you something back. And if you were a kid living in Akron, Ohio, who was just in this cultural wasteland that had no connection to these places that you'd heard about, like Carnaby Street or Greenwich Village or Sunset Strip. You knew these places existed somewhere. They just weren't in Akron. And nobody could send out a piece of art to these people, and sometimes they would send them something back, and it was pretty exciting. And I started. And because of my myopia, it was an easy size for me to work on because, even my right now my glasses they're to get 20/20 vision. It's like I'm looking into a doorknob
because they're so thick.
Yeah, because I'm bending the walls when I go like this, and you just learn to ignore it. So
wow,
let you be warned if you ever get in a car with me.
but driving.
Yeah, so. So these size cards was good, and then I realized it was kind of more they were autobiographical, and they were kind of like a diary. So I started saving them, and when Devo was traveling, that was a way I could still keep doing visual things, and I could write lyrics and things like that, and collect them on these pieces of paper, and. Yeah, so zoom ahead 40-some years, and now there's 350, I don't even know how many books that each have 100 of these things. That's one of the few things I actually was capable of archiving successfully in my life.
Well, there's a lot more in the museum exhibit as well. All right, now, I did notice in the credits for Pee-wee's Playhouse when that started, music by Mark Mothersbaugh. And after that, when my kids started listening to Rugrats, same thing. You did come to Hollywood through a kind of a circuitous route.
Yeah, I mean, after Devo, just after we saw people get shot at our school, we thought, well, how do you change things? It's not through rebellion in this country. They just put you down like that when they finally had enough. And so we looked around to see who was changing things, and it looked to us like it was Madison Avenue. We were listening to these diabolical commercials on TV and the radio where there'd be like somebody in a Burger King commercial to the tune of Pachelbel's Canon going, hold the pickles, hold the lettuce special. And it was like this beautiful piece of music that had been subverted into a ditty to sell crap to Americans. And I was impressed. I thought, well, the techniques are how you do it. You go into the belly of the beast. And so that led us to Hollywood. And, I found out that working on TV and film and in commercials and in video, you could do a lot, and you could put a lot of things right out in front of people, and they wouldn't necessarily notice it, but in the same way that Whippet lured people into Devo, and then they later would go, "What does this song Jocko Homo mean?" or you know, "What is freedom? What do they mean? Freedom of choice is what you want. Freedom of choice? No, freedom of choice is what you got. Freedom from choice is what you want." And so, you know, it's like we like the idea of you know, giving Devo the acid test and like just going right into middle, as close as we could to middle America, which was kind of hard for us because we were pretty far out on the fringe of things to begin with.
Yeah. And yet it worked out really well. I mean, you know, the scores to the kid shows worked out really well. And then you hooked up with Wes Anderson. About a year or so ago, I sat a bunch of my friends down and said, "You have to watch Moonrise Kingdom. It has the best use of sound and music I have ever seen in a film. The way he uses the Benjamin Britten, the way Alexandre Desplat does the scoring." And then what did you do in that film?
I was more the conceptual artist for it, and did field drums for the kids and for the campsites, mm-hmm. and mixed it with tom-toms so that it would be kind of like somewhere between this kind of fantastic Indians meet cowboys kind of sound design. But the movie, although my part was relegated to being just this one small area, the movie actually gave me an opportunity to do something. It inspired me to do something else, and that was, I was looking at footage of the kids running through the woods with no sound on it that Wes had sent me, and I thought, wow, it's kind of weird without any natural, you know, wind blowing or birds or anything. And I went over to this, I have a lot of collections, I'm a collector, and I started going through this collection of bird calls, and I was playing these bird calls and started writing music for bird calls, and I thought, well, I'd love to write a bird call orchestra. And I kind of forgot about the movie and just got into that for a while. And it led to meeting a guy who builds carousel calliopes, and we built this machine that plays like about 50 or 60 bird calls at once, and you can control it with a keyboard so that they would be playing in real time. So it wasn't just like you were playing samples, which would quickly just sound like samples, but you would have this device that you could adjust constantly, and so now I have this new instrument.
The orchestrion.
Yes.
Which, did you know that Pat Metheny was also at around the same time inventing his orchestrion?
Well, he worked with the same engineer that was like building those things. Yeah. And I learned from some of his mistakes because he had this brave idea that he was going to control it in real time live, and there's just inherent delays, and it was an impractical idea, although it was a brave and wonderful concept of what he did. It was hard to make it pay off the way he was trying to, and so I went for mine is a combination of things that are pre-recorded, and I can control the machine with a computer.
And they're also, again, visually, they're sculptures of a sort. I mean, they're part of this exhibit as well, and they're really interesting to look at.
It's a really interesting machine because there's, you know, like little leather sacks that are getting tapped by some sort of a device that is making a peeping sound, or there's rubber tubes with little whistles on them are being shook by the machine, or it's just blowing air through cuckoos and hummingbird calls and things like that, and there's slides that have to be manipulated. So there was a lot of mechanics involved in it. So it's kind of an interesting machine to watch it play.
So the orchestrions, you can see some of them on our website at soundcheck.org, and they will be part of the exhibit that opens October 30th at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver. And over the next couple of years, we'll travel around and eventually wend its way to New York. There is the accompanying book. Both are called Mark Mothersbaugh, Myopia. The book is out on November 4th, and Mark's been here with us in the Soundcheck studio today. Mark, it's an almost overwhelming amount of stuff, but congratulations on the exhibit and the book, and thanks for joining us.
It's an honor to be here with you.
That's part of the soundtrack to The Lego Movie, which came out earlier this year. It was composed by my guest, Mark Mothersbaugh. Up next, live music from Mike Hadrius, a.k.a. Perfume Genius. His newest album, Too Bright, is an electronically textured telling of some painfully personal stories. We'll talk with him about the bullying and homophobia that inspired some of the album's songs, and his band will play live. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Mike Hadrius has been releasing dark, personal, piano-backed songs under the name Perfume Genius since 2008. But his newest album, Too Bright, takes that template and expands it with electronic textures and pulsating declarations. But at their root, Perfume Genius's songs still tell honest, sometimes painfully honest, stories, like the one he's going to begin with. Perfume Genius is here in the Soundcheck studio, and this song is called My Body. That is Perfume Genius, the work of Mike Hadrius, who is the singer and songwriter. The song is called My Body, and you'll find it on the new Perfume Genius record called Too Bright. Mike Hadrius is here with us on Soundcheck. Welcome.
Yep. Hi.
With Alan Wyfels on the keyboards, Tom Bromley was playing bass on that song. He'll switch to guitar momentarily. Hervé Bécart behind the drum kit. And Mike, this album is very direct. You're calling out homophobia and kind of gay stereotypes. So very personal songwriting, as we've come to expect from you.
Right.
What about the person on the receiving end of the song? When you're writing these songs, do you think of, you know, how we're going to kind of get them out here?
I do. But I've noticed, like, if I start from somewhere very personal, somehow that ends up being more empowering and impactful to the listener. You know, a lot of the things I wanted to talk about, if I was just to talk about the themes and lose that personal element, it ends up kind of really corny or after school especially.
You know, right,
so,
right.
So I always kind of start with something that's going to empower me or that's going to heal something for me, and that ends up translating a lot better.
Right. But, I mean, do you have, like, in your mind's eye, do you have an idealized listener that you're writing to?
I suppose. I guess just weirdos in general. Like, you know, anybody that needs it. I guess since some of the themes are so specific and explicit to my experience, people think that somehow I'm only singing for people that can 100% identify with me, which is not true. I'm trying to sing and for anybody that, you know, is othered or feels different. And everybody has something like that, no matter
isn't that
how.
Everybody?
Yeah, pretty much. But so I'm singing to for a part of everyone, yeah.
Yeah. So talking about gay stereotypes, you know, we expect one of the stereotypes is that, you know, it is kind of artsy, piano-based, you know. And I mean, you have...
No, I'll take it, I guess.
Yeah, you have, even on this record, some very, you know, art rock, kind of piano-based.
Uh-huh.
The opening track sounds like Schubert, almost.
Okay.
Okay? You're okay with that?
Sure.
But then you have things like My Body and Queen, which are much more aggressive and much more kind of in your face. And that seems to be, for you, a kind of a different tack musically.
It is. And, you know, to be honest, I felt... Especially my second album had some badass, strong songs, but the music underneath it was a lot of times very pleasant and sweet, even though the subject matter was dark, and people don't seem to respond as well. And this song, a lot of the times when I'm angry, the music sounds angry, you know, and I think that's a lot easier for people to understand. And I don't mean that in a condescending way. I think it's just people, you know, if they want to... people like loud music.
Right. So. And, you know, very often people don't know what the words are.
Exactly, yeah. And I think I'm very obsessive about the words, and that's what I usually listen to first, but not everybody's like that.
Right. So do you consider Too Bright a dark album?
Yeah. And I liked how the title sort of was almost rebellious in itself, just because the subject matter is fairly dark for most of it.
And I'm sure, you know, I know that at some point along the way, someone must have said to you, you know, if you just kind of cool it with the gay thing a little bit, you'll get a wider audience. And you've clearly chosen not to listen
to that. Oh, yeah. I did the opposite. I mean, that's exactly why I released the first single being Queen, and why, you know, I wore a skin-tight, glittering picture on the cover.
And in the video.
In the video, too. Yeah. So didn't work.
So Queen...
said that to me.
Queen is kind of like a statement of identity, of empowerment. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah. I guess it's just kind of a culmination. It's a reaction to all the crap I got growing up and for something I had no control over, which growing up, used to, I would internalize all that and feel very ashamed or embarrassed or, you know, self-conscious. And that song's essentially like, if I do make you uncomfortable at the gas station, you know what I mean? Because my nails are painted or I'm wearing like silky robes, that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, just back up and let me walk by, you know, and I'm I'm kind of throwing it back at them. So telling them if they're scared of me, then to be scared because I'm scary.
All right. Well, let's hear the song. This song is called Queen. It's Perfume Genius live on Soundcheck.
Don't you know you're queen? Ripped fever, flower bloom at my feet. Don't you know you're queen? Quiet, peanut,
That is Perfume Genius live on Soundcheck with a song called Queen. That is from his newest album called Too Bright, which is out now. Once again, Perfume Genius is the work of Mike Hadrius, who's here with us on Soundcheck, along with Alan Wyfels on keyboards, Hervé Bacar behind the drums, Tom Bromley on bass and guitar. So it was interesting, Mike, to hear you say, you know, I mean, it's kind of a funny line that no one is safe when I sashay, but the idea that you can feel that you are the scary one, having been bullied as a teenager, mm-hmm. as a kid, and probably being the scared person, to kind of turn that around. How did you come to that? Was that through the kind of the songwriting process?
That line or that
idea? No, that idea.
I think just from growing up and kind of shaking off that victim-y way of looking at things, but having that kind of stuff still happen. I mean, a lot less frequently than when I was in high school, for sure.
Yeah.
But when it did happen, I noticed that it was, I like kind of saw through whatever anger and anything. It was actually, they're kind of frightened. You know what I mean? They're scared. And that was a really strange thing to realize, and in a weird way, kind of exciting, at least creatively, when I thought about it. Because, you know, definitely, that's not how I took it or what I noticed when I was younger.
Right. So was songwriting, was music kind of a therapy? Was it useful to you in this process?
Oh, big time. You know, and I did a lot of other, you know, I had a lot of other ways that I self-medicated for a long time.
Yeah.
And when I quit those, I didn't lose needing something to kind of process through.
Mm-hmm.
Just because in my daily life, you know, I'm not very good at that. But somehow music was a way for me to be usually more patient and compassionate about experiences that I had, and a way for me to think about the big picture of stuff and kind of let go and stop being so wrapped up in my own head and kind of see what was actually going on.
Right. Mm-hmm. So musically, you know, you studied piano. Mm-hmm. So what were your musical, who were your kind of influences, your forebears? Did you study classical piano?
I did. I was a really bad student. I mean, I never learned how to read music. So my teacher eventually just gave up, and she would play like a few bars and then I would copy her. But that's not typical.
No, it's not.
For this album, I thought a lot about a few different people. Like, I was thinking a lot about Elvis. I like the idea of sort of affecting that really overly kind of arrogant, swaggery dude style.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know, I like the end of my version of that. And so I think he's a big influence. And just like weirdos and people that were like, are not afraid to be deadly serious, or when they're going to be dark, to go 100% dark and not like wink afterwards or apologize or say just kidding.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like PJ Harvey and, Diamanda Galas and a lot of kind of...
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, Diamanda Galas, for folks who don't know her, is like one of the furies from Greek mythology when mm-hmm. she takes the stage, and the nicest person off stage.
Is she? Oh,
yes.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
Kind of. I kind of think I would be kind of awesome if she's just as intense and close to whatever demonic source she's tapping, just in her, you know, in person.
Yeah.
At Denny's or something.
The album is Too Bright. It's the work of Perfume Genius. You heard, Mike, of course, about the Supreme Court decision not to decide recently to look at various states' approaches to gay marriage. So now it's suddenly legal in a lot more states mm-hmm. than it's not. Your tour will take you through some of those states where it's still not legal. Do you think about that sort of thing when you're kind of looking at your itinerary?
Kind of. I mean, in a kind of a defiant way. Like, I was just reading about the protests in France, too, and I almost felt like somebody should book me a flight so I can go over there, because I have some few things to say to some people.
So you mean people in France who are protesting against gay rights?
Right, yeah. Just roll me out there. I'll sing a few songs for them.
The album's called Too Bright, the latest from Perfume Genius. And Mike, it's been great having you and the band here playing for us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
You have a song to play us out with?
Sure.
What's this?
It's called All Along.
All right. Once again, you'll hear Mike Hadrius and the rest of the band performing as Perfume Genius here in the Soundcheck studio. This song called All Along. Thank you.
would trust me to my man, earthly or divine or otherwise, is no business of mine. Wasted my time, you wasted my time. Deep down, I never did feel right. Sometimes that feeling's a lie. You wasted my time, you wasted my time.
That's the band Perfume Genius with their song All Along, performed right here in the Soundcheck studio. Find out more about Perfume Genius on our website, soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, Soundcheck's executive producer Joel Meyer interviews the man behind the TV series that made him want to work in radio in the first place, WKRP in Cincinnati. That show is being issued on DVD with most of the music from its original soundtrack. No mean feat for a show that featured the Rolling Stones and Bob Marley, Bruce Springsteen, and Paul McCartney, among many others. We'll talk with creator Hugh Wilson. Plus, another beloved TV series, Twin Peaks, is making a return to TV after 25 years. We'll talk about the music from the original David Lynch, Mark Frost series and what we might expect musically from Twin Peaks 2.0 and live music from the band Streets of Laredo. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.